The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post in a book entitled South. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Let me begin with a question. Have you ever had a place that captured your travel fancy, but it was unlikely you would ever go there? Well, that describes my kind of long-time curiosity about Antarctica, the home of the South Pole. Today on Armchair Traveler, the Washington Post travel writer, Andrea Sachs, explains why Antarctica is becoming easier to visit. Here's how to get to the bottom of the world. Now, her article is from the February 21st, 2020 issue of the Washington Post. So let us begin. Starts with a little caption on a cover photo that says, "Adventurers on a Quark Expeditions cruise from the tip of Argentina to Antarctica visit a penguin colony populated by Adelaide chicks waiting for their parents to return from sea with food." So, that gives you kind of a graphic description of what we're about to experience, among other things. Let's begin. She writes, "A few weeks ago, I was standing in the immigration line at the Buenos Aires airport, inching closer to Antarctica, when I learned about a drive-by cruise to the White Continent. We don't get off the ship, the American traveler said, but I am still going to count it as my seventh continent. I don't know if Shackleton would approve. He worked hard for his landing stamp, but the polar explorer would be amazed at how Antarctic travel has evolved. The isolated destination with the unforgiving environment no longer feels so far away or so grueling. A sea crossing from the tip of Argentina takes about 2 days, shorter than a transatlantic cruise. By plane, the flight from Puntas Arenas, Chile, lasts all of 2 hours. Once there, you can ski or stand up paddle, sip champagne in an inflatable tenderboat surrounded by seals, or ask your private butler to press your favorite humpback quail pajamas." Well, you can see and sniff penguins from the comfort of your stateroom balcony without sullying your boots with guano. Well, Antarctica is becoming more accessible, said Colleen McDaniel, editor-in-chief of Cruise Critic, who recently traveled to the southernmost continent with Abercrombie & Kent, a luxury tour operator. "There are a lot more options than there used to be," she said, checking off my seventh continent, a half-price voyage to Antarctica. Over the past 10 years, cruises to Antarctica have grown exponentially in number and style. Previously, mainly research ships ventured to the bottom of the world. Then expedition vessels, a category of smaller ships that emphasizes the natural world over onboard indulgences. Now, cruise lines, commonplace in the Caribbean and the Mediterranean, such as Holland America and Silversea, are appearing alongside such swashbuckling stalwarts as Aurora Expeditions, Quark Expeditions, and Lindblad Expeditions, a partner with National Geographic. Alex Burich, managing director of Antarctica Travel Center in Melbourne, Australia, said more than 20 operators lead trips to Antarctica, a mix of polar scientists and behemoth cruise lines that have added the destination to their global lineup. "We have as many luxury polar operators as we do more traditional expedition cruise operators," he says, "and a slew of new ships with even greater ambitions are on the way. Call it the next wave of Antarctic cruising. A lot of the ships are pushing the limit of what an expedition cruise can do," said Todd Smith, founder and president of Adventure Smith Explorations, which specializes in small ship adventure cruises. "They are faster, smoother, and more environmentally friendly, and they have a lot more amenities," Smith said. "The toys would not seem out of place on a Tycoon's mega yacht. The ultra extras include helicopters, Quark's Expeditions Ultramarine, science centers with microscopes, that's Hurtigruten, infinity hot tubs, and an underwater vehicle that can ascend 1,000 feet, found in Lindblad's Endurance, electric snowmobiles, and tethered hot air balloon, Ponet le Commandant Chacot, and a 7-person submersible crystals Crystal Endeavor. So all of those ships containing those toys, as she describes them. On a more practical level, Burridge said cruisers can also expect improved loading areas for tenders and kayaks, upgraded mudrooms, and cushier cabins. Of course, the ship should enhance your Antarctic experience and not subsume it. The perks are nice, but the natural attractions are even better. Case in point, since returning from Antarctica, I am still talking about the courting dance of an Adelaide penguin performed for me if only I could live on a bed of rocks and a diet of krill, and not the yoga classes, smoothie bar, a sauna with iceberg views of the Quark's Ocean Endeavor. To help adventurers realize their Antarctic dream, I contacted several experts for planning advice, such as when to go and how to choose a ship. I also tapped into my own recent journey. My takeaway, be flexible, say yes to every opportunity on and off the ship, and if a penguin offers you love, accept it. Points of departure. Most of the smaller ships sail round trip from Ushua, Argentina, a flea-hour flight from Buenos Aires, and operators can tack on a domestic charter flight or book your own arrangements and spend a few days in the lively port town near Tierra del Fuego National Park. During the two-day journey to the continent, the vessels cross the Drake Passage, a notoriously rough patch of water between South America's Cape Horn and the South Shetland Islands. Don't let Drake's reputation scare you. Our conditions were as placid as a duck pond. The larger vessels, such as those run by Holland America, Celebrity, and Princess, required more substantial ports and often sail from Santiago, Chile, to Buenos Aires, or vice versa. Ships also depart from New Zealand and Australia, but the trip takes at least a week one way and can cost twice as much as cruises based in South America. Travelers with rubbery sea legs or queasy stomachs can skip the Drake Passage and fly directly to the South Shetland Islands, about 75 miles north of the peninsula. The charter planes, part of a fly cruise package, land at a Chilean airstrip on King George Island. There are no commercial docks or cruise ship terminals in Antarctica, so tender boats transport passengers from land to ship. To be sure, the advantage of flying is the quick crossing, but what you gain in speed, you lose in sightseeing. During our at-sea days, we spotted sei and humpback whales, several species of albatross and petrels, and dolphins leaping into the ship's spray. A fiery sunset over the Beagle Channel appeared hot to the touch. We also used those free days to learn about our destination through daily lectures and got a jump start on bonding with the other passengers and expedition crew. Ship captains have more wiggle room than airplane pilots, and Smith warns air travelers about the risk of delays or cancellations due to inclement conditions. If there is a flight delay because of weather, he said, you can have a domino effect. Smith suggests padding your itinerary with extra days before and after the flight so you don't jeopardize the cruise portion of your trip or your flight home. When to go? Well, Antarctica's summer is shorter than hockey season, or ice hockey season, from November through March. The peak time, December and January, is often more expensive, but the 20-plus hours of sunlight, warmer temperatures, and typically calmer seas can help alleviate the financial pinch. The marine animals and seabirds have a small window to establish the next generation, so many species move at a rapid pace. Penguins typically court, mate, and lay their eggs in November and December. During the following 2 months, the fuzzy chicks are born and fatten up before they start to molt and resemble plucked feather dusters. On our late January to early February trip, for example, we saw gentoo, chinstrap, and Adelaide chicks waiting for their parents to return from the sea with their meal or chasing the food-dispensing adults around the rookery squawking their demands. The penguins shared ice floes and rocky outcroppings with fur, crab-eater, and leopard seals, which dip into penguin flocks like a moviegoer's hand in a tub of popcorn. Well, whales are focused on feeding early in the season but turn more social as the months wear on. We saw several humpbacks, including a sleeping youngster and a mink whale that flashed its tail several times, swam under our tender and bobbed its head like a buoy, surveying us with its giant eye. By the way, this behavior is called spy hopping. For snow sports and outdoorsy shore excursions, the earlier months of summer are better, Burridge said. As the season progresses, the temperatures rise and it can be harder to find a good or safe place to ski or snowshoe, he said. Camping also fits into this time frame. For environmental reasons, travelers can only sleep on snow and ice, not bare earth. Kayaking and stand-up paddling take place all season long, but the staff might cancel the excursion in the event of high waves, storms, or excessive ice. The polar plunge is always a go. Choosing a ship. The International Association of Antarctica Tour Operators, IAATO, I-A-A-T-O, is the guardian angel of Antarctica. Seven expedition operators established the group in 1991 with the mission to advocate and promote the practice of safe and environmentally responsible private sector travel to the Antarctic. IAATO organizes its members into four categories. C1 are traditional expedition ships that carry 13 to 200 passengers. C2 are mid-sized vessels with 201 to 500 people. CR are cruisers with more than 500 passengers. And YA are sailing or motor yachts that carry no more than a dozen guests. This season, the organization claimed 40 C1 and C2 members and expects the number to increase by a dozen over the next 2 years. Aside from small yachts, none of the passenger vessels operating in the Antarctic are operated outside of IAATO at this point, said Haley Collins, a IAATO spokesperson. When selecting a vessel, you should first consider passenger load. Ships carrying more than 500 travelers are described as cruise only, which means passengers are not permitted to go on shore. According to IAATO, nearly 10,900 passengers during the 2018-2019 season visited the continent without stepping foot on it. By comparison, 44,600 cruisers sailed on ships with landing privileges. Princess Cruises explains the experience. Antarctic Peninsula is a scenic cruising site. Ships will slowly travel past while a knowledgeable port lecturer points out significant sights you'll be able to see from on board. This arrangement is ideal for travelers with mobility issues or a tight budget. A 16-day Princess cruise starts at about $3,000 per person double. A smaller ship typically charges at least twice as much for a shorter trip. Whether you can claim Antarctica as your seventh continent is a debate best hashed out over drinks. Ships permitted to disembark passengers must also follow strict guidelines. The biggest one is that only 100 people are allowed to visit a landing site at a time. Vessels with more than the maximum number will divvy up the groups, with half exploring by land, the other by tender. Each inflatable boat fits about a dozen people. Then they switch. For example, on our trip, Quark divided our 200-strong group into four parties named after critters. Once the crew called our team, penguins head to the mudroom. We had about 10 minutes to get suited up, borrowed muck boots and keeper parka, and line up for loading. The two-part outings lasted a couple of hours. If risky conditions prevented us from landing, the expedition leader would extend the sea portion. Upon returning, we would scrub our boots and rinse them in a tub of disinfectant to avoid cross-contamination. A staff member would welcome us back with hot cocoa or cider. When the ship is on the move, guests fill their hours with lectures by experts knowledgeable in such subjects as seabirds, whales, geology, and Antarctic politics, entertainment, more homespun than Atlantic City, and eating so much food. On the Ocean Endeavor, I ran from activity to activity, attending talks and yoga classes, plus any special events such as a concert performed by a trio of crew members and an auction to raise money for a penguin foundation. I took catnaps in the sauna. McDaniel's Ponant ship, Le Lirial, organized a painting class and happy hours with live music. Each company has its own personality and specialty, said Smith, who has traveled to Antarctica a half dozen times, including a recent ski trip with Aurora Expeditions. I booked directly with Quark, which fit our style of travel, intimate, low-key, and time restrictions, 2 weeks. But if you need a sounding board, contact a specialist such as Adventure Smith. Read its ship overviews on the website or Antarctica Travel Center. You can check out its online primer. Or reach out to a cruise consultant. Gillian Clark, a cruise specialist, first visited Antarctica 20 years ago and indicates a lot has changed since then, but fortunately, a lot has also stayed the same. So, if you'd like to travel, and by the way, I've discovered some more articles about going to Antarctica recently, and I'll try to get some of those on in future episodes. In the meantime, just need to kind of step back for a moment, if you will. In fact, 106 years ago, Irish-born and British explorer Ernest Shackleton, whose name was mentioned, undertook what he called the last great journey on Earth. As it turned out, it was his last expedition to Antarctica. Starting in 1914, Shackleton and his crew traveled 600 miles from South Georgia through the treacherous and often ice-filled waters of the Weddell Sea, often battling bad weather, to reach the frozen continent. With the help of New Zealand journalist Edward Saunders, Shackleton described his experience in his book, South. It was first published in 1919. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to read from Chapter 2, which is called New Land. So join me as he describes his experience going to Antarctica. The condition of the pack improved in the evening of New Year's Day, and we're talking January 1st, 1915. And we progressed rapidly until a moderate gale came up from the east, with continuous snow. Early in the morning of January 2nd, we got into thick, old pack ice. The position then was latitude 69 degrees 49 minutes south, longitude 15 degrees 42 minutes west, and the run for the last 24 hours had been 124 miles south, or 3 degrees west, which was cheering, as he describes it. This good run had made me feel hopeful of sighting the land on the following day, but we were delayed by heavy pack and also by the gale. I was becoming anxious to reach land on account of the dogs, which I had been greatly pleased when we had started, but owing to a lack of exercise, they were now becoming run down. Difficulties continued to beset us, and on the 4th, we had been steaming and dodging about over an area of 20 square miles for 50 hours, trying to find an opening in the south, southeast, or southwest, but all the leads ran north, northeast, or northwest. It was as if the spirits of the Antarctic were pointing us to the backward track, the track we were determined not to follow. Our desire was to make easting as well as southing, so that, if possible, we might reach the land east of Ross's farther south and well east of Coates' land. Solid pack, however, barred the way to the south, but on the 6th, with the ship moored to a floe, I took the opportunity to exercise the dogs. Their excitement when they got onto the floe was intense. Several of them managed to get into the water, and their muzzles did not prevent them from having some hot fights. On the following day, when we were able to make some progress, killer whales began to be active around us, and I had to exercise caution in allowing anyone to leave the ship. These beasts have a habit of locating a resting seal by looking over the edge of the floe, then striking through the ice from below in search of a meal. They would not distinguish between seal and man. On the 8th and 9th, fortune was with us, and the run southward in blue water, with a path clear ahead and the miles falling away behind us, was a joyful experience after the long struggle through the ice lanes. But, like other good things, our spell of free movement had to end, and the Endurance encountered the ice again at 1 a.m. on the 10th. At noon, our position was latitude 72 degrees 2 minutes south, longitude 16 degrees 7 minutes west, and we were now near the land discovered by Dr. W. S. Bruce, leader of the Scotia Expedition in 1904, and named by him Coates Land. Dr. Bruce encountered an ice barrier in latitude 72 degrees 18 minutes south, longitude 10 degrees west, and from his description of rising slopes of snow and ice with shoaling water off the barrier wall, the presence of land was clearly indicated. It was up those slopes at a point as far south as possible that I planned to begin the march across the Antarctic continent. All hands now were watching for the coast described by Dr. Bruce, and at 5 p.m., the lookout reported an appearance of land to the south-southeast. It seemed to be an island or a peninsula with a sound on its south side. At the time, we were passing through heavy, loose pack, and shortly before midnight, we broke into a lead of open sea along a barrier edge. The barrier was 70 feet high, with cliffs of about 40 feet, and the Scotia must have passed this point when pushing to Bruce's further south on March 6, 1904. Thick and overcast weather impeded our progress on the following days, but on the 12th, we were beyond the point reached by the Scotia, and the land underlying the ice sheet, which we were skirting, was new. At 4 p.m. on the 13th, when we were still following the barrier to the southwest, we reached a corner and found it receding abruptly to the southeast. Our way was blocked by very heavy pack, and we were unable to find an opening. We moored the ship to a floe and banked fires. Several young emperor penguins had been captured and brought aboard on the previous day, and two of them were still alive when the Endurance was brought alongside the floe. They promptly hopped onto the ice, turned around, bowed gracefully three times, and retired to the far side of the floe. There is something curiously human about the manner and movements of these birds. I was again concerned about the dogs. Some of them appeared to be ailing, and one dog had to be shot on the 12th. We did not move the ship on the 14th, but on the following day conditions had improved, and in the evening the Endurance was moving southward with sails set, and we continued to skirt the barrier in clear water. I was watching for possible landing places, though, as a matter of fact, unless compelled by necessity, I had no intention of landing north of Vashel Bay and Lutpo Land. Every mile gained towards the south meant a mile less sledging when the time came for the overland journey. Shortly before midnight on the 15th, we came abreast of the northern edge of a great glacier projecting beyond the barrier into the sea. It was about 400 feet high, and at its edge was a large mass of thick bay ice. The bay formed by the northern edge of this glacier would have made an excellent landing place, for it was protected from the southeasterly wind and was open only to a northerly wind. I named the place Glacier Bay and had reason later to remember it with regret. The Endurance steamed along the front of this glacier for about 17 miles, and at 4 a.m. on the 16th, we reached the edge of another huge glacial overflow from the ice sheet. We steamed along the front of this tremendous glacier for 40 miles, and then were held up by solid pack ice, which appeared to be held by stranded bergs. No further advance was possible for that day, but the noon observation showed that we had gained 124 miles to the southwest during the preceding 24 hours. We pushed the ship against a small berg, and a blizzard from the east-northeast prevented us from leaving the shelter of the berg on the following day, which was Sunday, January 17th, again 1915. The land, when the air was clear, seemed to rise 3,000 feet above the head of the glacier. Caird Coast, as I named it, connects Coates Land, discovered by Bruce in 1904, with Lutpo Land, discovered by Filchner in 1912. We were now close to the junction with Lutpo Land. The ship lay under the lee of the stranded berg until 7 a.m. on January the 18th, by which time the gale had moderated so much that we could sail to the southwest through a lane which had opened along the glacier front. And on the morning of the 19th, our position was latitude 76 degrees, 34 minutes south, longitude 31 degrees, 30 minutes west. The weather was good, but as the ice had closed around the ship during the night, no advance could be made. A survey of the position on the 20th showed that the Endurance was firmly beset. As far as the eye could reach from the masthead, the ice was packed heavily and firmly all around the ship in every direction. Many uneventful days followed. Moderate breezes from the east and southwest had no apparent effect upon the ice, and the ship remained firmly held. On the 27th, the 10th day of inactivity, I decided to let the fires out. We had been burning half a ton of coal a day to keep steam in the boilers, and as the bunkers now contained only 67 tons, representing 33 days steaming, we could not afford this expenditure of coal. During these days of waiting, we gradually collected a stock of seal meat, which the dogs needed, and which also made a very welcome change from our rations. Not until February 9th did I order steam to be raised in the hope of being able to proceed, but our effort failed. We could break the young ice, but the pack defied us, and the ship became jammed against soft floe. As there seemed small chance of making a move, I had the motor crawler and warper put on the floe for a trial run. The motor worked most successfully, running at about 6 miles an hour over slabs and ridges of ice hidden by a foot or two of soft snow. The surface was worse than we had expected to face on land or barrier ice. No important change in our situation took place during the second part of February. Early in the morning of the 14th, I ordered a good head of steam on the engines and set all hands to the floe with ice chisels, prickers, saws, and picks. All that day and most of the next, we worked strenuously to get the ship into the lead ahead of us. After terrific labor, we got the ship a third of the way to the lee, but about 400 yards of heavy ice still separated the Endurance from the water. And reluctantly, I was compelled to admit that further effort was useless. Every opening we made froze up again, quickly owing to the unseasonably low temperatures. The abandonment of the attack was a great disappointment to all hands. The men had worked so splendidly that they had deserved success, but the task was beyond our powers. I had not yet abandoned hope of getting clear, but by this time I was beginning to count on the possibility of having to spend a winter in the inhospitable arms of the pack. The sun, which had been above the horizon for 2 months, set at midnight on the 17th, and although it would not disappear until April, its slanting rays warned us of the approaching winter. We continued to accumulate a supply of seal meat and blubber, and all the excursions across the floes to shoot and bring in seals provided welcome exercise for all hands. On the 22nd, the Endurance reached the farthest point south of her drift, touching the 77th parallel of latitude longitude 35 degrees west. 77th parallel of latitude and longitude 35 degrees west. The summer had gone. Indeed, it had been scarcely with us at all. The temperatures were very, very low that day and night, and as the pack was freezing solidly around the ship, I could no longer doubt that the Endurance was confined for the winter. We must, I wrote, wait for the spring, which may bring us better fortune. If I had guessed a month ago that the ice would grip us here, I would have established our base at one of the landing places at the Great Glacier. But there seemed no reason to anticipate then that the fates would prove unkind. My chief anxiety is the drift. Where will the vagrant winds and currents carry the ship during the long winter months that are ahead of us? We will go west, no doubt, but how far? And will it be possible to break out of the pack early in the spring and reach Vashel Bay or some other suitable landing place? These are momentous questions for us, he wrote. On February 24th, we ceased to observe ship routine, and the Endurance became a winter station. Orders were given for the afterhold to be cleared and the stores checked so that we might know exactly how we stood for a siege by an Antarctic winter. The dogs went off the ship on the following day, their kennels being placed on the floe along the length of a wire rope to which the leashes were fashioned. They were obviously delighted to get off the ship, and we had already begun the training of teams. Hockey and football on the floe were our chief recreations, and all hands joined in many strenuous games. We kept our wireless apparatus rigged, but without result. Evidently, the distances were too great for our small planet. Wow. And then, of course, Chapter 3 details what it was like to spend the winter months in this ice pack, and I'll just read a couple of lines as we get near the end of our time. March opened with a severe northeasterly gale, which lasted until the 3rd of March, 1915. All hands were employed in clearing out the tween decks, which was to be converted into a living room and dining room for officers and scientists. Here, the carpenter erected the stove that had been intended for the store hut, and the quarters were made very snug. The dogs seemed indifferent to the blizzard and were content to lie most of the time curled into tight balls under the snow. So that is from South, the story of Ernest Shackleton's last expedition, 1914 to 1917, by Sir Ernest Shackleton. And that is our trip today on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, they may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.